Hello, and welcome to Volume 64 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll talk about hunting. We'll see what it takes to get a restricted use herbicide license. We'll talk about getting paid for doing what you're already doing. And we'll explore how the first Americans manipulated the environment. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. This is the 400th anniversary of the founding of Jamestown, the first permanent English colony in the U.S., but before Jamestown, there was DeSoto, and before DeSoto, there was Columbus, and before Columbus, there was, well, our first guest can explain. He's uniquely qualified to describe life in America before Columbus. His book is entitled 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. He's Charles Mann. Welcome, Mr. Mann.
Pleasure to be with you.
You've written about Native Americans before Columbus, and you said that they were living in balance with nature, but they had their thumb on the scale. What do you mean by that?
What meant was that they had changed the nature around and adapted it to their own needs, but done with real exquisite care and sophistication. In other words, they had created a balance of nature that depended on their own work and efforts. That was, and the changes they had made were thorough and persistent and supple, and something really to be thought of as so sophisticated as to be a kind of technology, rather than the kind of thing that we get in the textbooks, which is that they're living without touching the nature. Rather, they touched it superbly well.
Are you suggesting that there are lessons, ecological lessons, that we can learn in our own time from how Native Americans actively manipulated their environment?
Well, I think so. One of the things that we can learn is that their general approach, which was to change entire landscapes rather than to work in little bits and pieces, might be one way to think about how we should manage our own landscapes. Another is that much of our environmental legislation, consciously or not, is based on the idea that when Columbus landed, he was landing in essentially an untouched wilderness, a virgin landscape. And that, we now know, is simply not the case. And so if we want to maintain the kind of environment that was there before Columbus or approach it as near as possible, that means that we need some active human intervention.
If a forest owner wanted to restore his forest to the environmental conditions that existed before human intervention, do you suspect it would look like most people suspect it would look like, or would it be radically different if you're actively trying to put a forest in place that is before any sort of human intervention?
It would be quite different. I mean, to begin with, before any kind of human intervention, there was these, which would have been thousands and thousands of years ago, there were enormous numbers of very large animals that existed then that don't exist now. There's a wave of extinction that occurred about 15,000 years ago, and many of the forest species that we have today are essentially adapted for the presence of, things like mammoths, giant sloths, saber-toothed tigers, and the like, which obviously don't exist today. So then, on top of that, the forests that we have today went through thousands of years of being managed largely by fire, by native burning, which took place every year with a frequency much greater than would be natural from lightning and so forth. So if you tried to wind back the clock, you'd have to somehow de-adapt, if that's the right word, forests from these thousands of years being adapted from fire, and then go back and somehow recreate the role of these very large animals. And that would really be quite a tall order and create something that in contemporary context would be extremely artificial and would be only maintained by, enormous amount of human effort.
Could you paint a picture for us of what life was like and at least what the landscape looked like when Columbus did get here, if he were able to, go across the entire country? Would it be a single unbroken chain of hardwood forests that you would never see the hand of man?
No. What you would see would be, suppose you started with the northeast, what you would see is as you approach the coast, and we're imagining somehow flying over the coastline, what you would see along the coast would, for miles inland, would be cornfields, whole areas cleared in from forest. Then as you went further east, what you would see would be this a forest, but it wouldn't be the kind of deep, dark woods that was, you know, celebrated by Thoreau. Instead, it was a wide open forest, you know, quite park-like. In fact, people like John Smith at Jamestown wrote that the forests were so open that you could gallop a horse through the woods, or that you didn't even need a road. It was like carriages could just go right through the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And this is because the native peoples burned these forests to such a large extent. And then as you went to the grasslands, you know, the Great Plains and the associated grasslands, they began much before they did now. In some
eastern,
places like,
more in an easterly direction.
Yeah, more in an easterly direction, also in the western direction. And that was because they were as much as 30% larger than they are now. And again, they were maintained by native burning. The same thing was true of places like California and Florida, which were routinely burned by native peoples. So much burning was done, in fact, that a number of scientists are now researching the idea that when native peoples died out from disease in the 17th century, their burning stopped. And not only was there this extraordinary ecological change as these forests stopped being burned, but also there is global cooling because it previously dumped so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that it artificially maintained higher temperatures around the world.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. That we appreciate you joining us, Mr. Mann. Thank you for that perspective.
It's my pleasure.
Speaking of manipulating the environment, humans do play a role in releasing carbon into the atmosphere, which has something to do with climate change. But humans can also have a role in manipulating the environment by reducing carbon emissions. Teddy Reynolds, a forestry consultant in Arkansas and host of a radio program called Timber Talk, can enlighten us. Hello, Teddy.
Hey, good to be with you.
What are some of the timberland owners doing when they're thinking about selling carbon credit offsets? What is that?
Carbon that is sequestered or pulled out of the atmosphere by trees during photosynthesis is now considered a valued offset to the carbon that is put into the atmosphere by industries reliant on fossil-based fuels for energy.
Mm-hmm.
Industries that have joined the Chicago Climate Exchange have voluntarily made legal obligations to reduce carbon emissions 6% by 2010, with the ultimate goal to become carbon neutral sometime in the future. This will be accomplished with a combination of real reductions in emissions and the purchase of offsets. The carbon credits are marketed to U.S.-based companies on the Chicago Climate Exchange, which operates similar to Wall Street. Currently, there is only one approved program by the Chicago Climate Exchange for trees, which is for all afforested pine and hardwood timberlands in the United States planted after January 1, 1990. Afforested means trees planted in previously non-timbered areas, for example, tracts that were pasture or row crops prior to being planted. A minimum stocking of 250 trees per acre is also required for sign-up. Currently, there is a new program under review to include working forests, which includes all forest land regardless of origin, and they are expected to be approved and activated within a year.
Oh, that could include plantations as well.
That's correct.
What kind of rates of return can timberland owners expect if they get involved in selling these carbon credit offsets?
Carbon credits are currently selling for approximately $3.50 per metric ton on the Chicago Climate Exchange. As an example, Loblolly Pine Plantation, 0 to 5 years of age, sequester 2.2 metric tons per acre per year, while plantations 11 to 15 years of age sequester 7.8 metric tons per acre per year. The sign-up period and payments are retroactive through 2003 and end in 2010. For example, if you list a 100-acre pine plantation that was 11 years old in 2003, then you will receive payments for sequestered carbon between 2003 to 2010. Based on current carbon trading rates, during the 8-year sign-up, a 100-acre Loblolly Pine Plantation will yield $21,945 to the landowner.
Let's pause on that a second. You've got a loblolly plantation that's 11 years old, and you've got 100 acres of it. You had mentioned the 11-year-old trees can sequester, I think you said, 7.8 metric tons.
That's correct.
Per acre per year.
Correct.
And so if you have that over that same period of time, like you said, an eight-year period.
That is correct.
An eight-year period would result in almost $22,000.
Correct.
For that entire period. And you're also talking about some retroactivity back to 2003, even if you signed up now. So bottom line, for an eight-year investment, almost $22,000 for an 11-year-old plantation. Am I on track on that?
That is correct. And I was assuming it was 11 at 2003.
Yeah.
And
apparently,
so
as they get older, the trees
start.
Get older, they sequester more carbon.
That is correct.
Okay. That makes sense.
And then also, just to throw in a percent there, that means if you throw that into your to see the impact on internal rate of return, you actually get an increase of about 1.6% on your internal real annual rate of return, internal rate of return on the plantation during its life.
Okay. I think they hold back some money. You were about to say something?
Yes. They actually, it should be noted that the carbon credits will be reduced by 20%, which is held back in an insurance pool to cover carbon credits potentially lost to catastrophic events during the eight-year sign-up, and then it's refunded, or that balance that is remaining, assuming there's no catastrophic events at the end accordingly.
Okay. Real quick, how do you enlist in this program, and are there fees?
Landowners can enlist through aggregates such as Iowa Farm Bureau, Delta Institute, there are others, who have purchased seats on the Chicago Climate Exchange and sell the carbon tons in large metric ton blocks. The aggregates charge usually 8 to 10% commission, and the Chicago Climate Exchange charges a fee of 20 cents per ton. If you enlist less than 2,000 annual tons with an aggregate, then all you basically need to provide is contact information, verification of ownership, acreage, planting confirmation. However, the verification requirements increase when you enlist over 2,000 annual sequestered tons.
Okay, so an aggregate is a company or an entity that's purchased a seat on the Chicago Climate Exchange, and that's who you sign up with.
That is correct.
Okay, great. Well, Teddy, thank you for that. We appreciate you enlightening us on that very interesting topic.
You're welcome.
You've probably been made aware that the forest industry has historically owned a portion of the total forested acres in the South. They purchased this land many years ago in an effort to be vertically integrated. That means owning not only the manufacturing process, but also the raw materials. That's changing, as Joe Fury, who's a broker of forest land, can help us understand. Hello, Joe.
Hey, Hayes. How you doing?
What's happening to timberland ownership in the South?
Well, you're right. There has been, in the last 18 to 24 months, probably is when we've noticed a major shift, that there has been a shift in timberland ownership, and your major timber companies have been selling off their holdings, their property holdings, fairly quickly, and it's really opened the door for a lot of private investors, not only private investors such as TMOs and REITs, but also your individual. So there has rapidly become a lot of individual investors being able to get back in the market and invest in timberland.
Mm-hmm. Where are the buyers for this land that's turning over? Where are they coming from?
A lot of the buyers right now are, I'm sure many people have heard the real estate boom happening in Florida. Now it's kind of back on the downswing, but they're still coming hot and heavy out of Florida up to, we primarily work the central part of the state, the Montgomery area, in about a 60-mile radius outside of it, and they're still coming hot and heavy and buying land here in the central part and investing in the timberland, but also investing in the hunting aspect of what we have up here.
Mm. Well, you mentioned they're coming from Florida, places like that. What's the type of a profile for that type buyer, and how are they affecting land prices?
Well, what they're doing is, because of the high real estate boom down there, they're having a surplus of money to be able to come up here and do a lot of what they call 1031 exchanges.
Mm-hmm.
And they are coming up this way, getting into our fine hunting that we have here in Alabama, and where used to 2-3 years ago, people would buy timberland for the investment in timber as a primary source. It's actually to these guys becoming a secondary source where they're really investing in the hunting aspect, and where a seller of timberland, if they not only have timber on their property but also have it set up as what you would call a lock and key hunting operation, where you have all of your food plots, your feed for your deer, maybe a lodge, something to stay, they are paying big dollars for that. One example would be a client that we had out of central part of Florida came up and bought a 260-acre tract in Bullitt County, which is a county east of Montgomery, and probably $600 to $700 an acre in timber on the property, and paid over $5,000 an acre for it.
Okay, these are recreations. Okay,
they're really using mm-hmm. it as a recreational
yeah.
spot, and then if it's got some timber investment on the property, that's just kind of a plus for them.
Okay.
Whereas it used to be
the major consideration.
A reverse, right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's interesting. There's a real change there, Joe. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. Well, you may have thought of your forest as a tree farm, but you may not have thought of it as a tree pharmacy. Professor Michael Flannery has studied the properties of plants in Alabama with some interesting results. Welcome, Professor Flannery.
Good morning.
Are there medicinal plants in Alabama?
There's a great many. There's hundreds, as a matter of fact, if not thousands. We tend to think of herbs as, well, when we think of plants and when we take a stroll through our forests, we don't, as you point out, tend to think of them in a medicinal light. But historically, of course, most of the pharmaceuticals that we've used and most of the medicines that have been compounded both abroad and in the United States have been botanical in nature, and a great many of them can be found in our very own forests right here in the state of Alabama.
What guidelines or data or, is there that bear out that there actually are these medicinal plants in our forests?
Well, as you might suspect, as I said, since the use of these are historical in nature, our best resources for knowing what those are actually historical, and we have really two of them. One is an early source from the Civil War period. It's by Francis Peyre Porcher called Resources of the Southern Fields and Forests. This book contains thousands of plants for all kinds of uses, and it was really commissioned by the Surgeon General, Samuel Preston Moore, the Surgeon General of the Confederacy, to find medicinal substitutes for plants that they couldn't get because of the Union blockade. What Porcher did was develop an unprecedented list of medicinal plants, largely focused on southern availability, and that was published in South Carolina in 1863. A little bit later, one of our own adopted sons, he was originally from Germany but spent most of his adult life in Mobile, Alabama, was Charles T. Moore. And Charles T. Moore published an article, a paper that he actually presented at the Alabama Pharmaceutical Association in May of 1890, entitled The Medicinal Plants of Alabama. And he included 141 plants that he had witnessed himself here in Alabama, and as a pharmacist, he knew their use. So it's an interesting list, and that's sort of what our base starting point when we start thinking about medicinal plants in this state. Now, if you think of what plants they are, one of the most common ones all around you historically of medicinal use has been the pine, in particular the white pine. And before we got together to talk, I thought I'd just check the U.S. Dispensatory, which is our best source of information. From 1889, it had this to say, which I think is sort of fascinating. And it's talking about the white pine. It says, in former times, large quantities were collected in New England, but the turpentine trees of that section of the Union are entirely exhausted. And our commerce has been until recently almost exclusively supplied from North Carolina and the southeastern parts of Virginia. Within a few years, however, attention has been turned to the collection of this valuable product in Georgia and Florida. And there is no doubt that in time an abundant supply will be derived from the vast pine forests which occupy the southern portion of our country bordering on the Gulf of Mexico. So even the editors of the U.S. Dispensatory were beginning to appreciate the tremendous resource availability within the southeastern United States in general, and Alabama in particular, in terms of medicinal plant harvesting.
Well, that's interesting. You know, we have a new way of looking at our forest now, and we'll have some other links next to your image where people can learn some more about it. We sure do appreciate you joining us, Professor Flannery.
Very good. Thanks for inviting me.
Our next guest started from scratch with her hunting lease program. She took land, which was not leased, learned how to do it, and is now generating money to fund other pursuits. She's Janet Drake, and we've invited her to gain the benefit of her experience. Welcome, Janet.
Thank you, Janie.
I'm sorry, Janie. Excuse me. Janie, what were the first steps that you would recommend that forest landowners take before they lease land to hunters?
Well, first let me tell you that I didn't know anything, and I can I wished I had known a little bit before I went on my first track to show it. And you need a general information about habits of deer. Probably if someone is a hunter, then you already know this, but there are a lot of people that are like me that didn't know it. For example, you need to know what a rut is, what a rub is, what a scrape is, eating habits, the favorite foods that a deer likes. And if you don't know some of this, you're putting yourself at a disadvantage. It's like trying to be a car salesman without knowing anything about the car.
Mm-hmm. What are your experiences in figuring out how much to charge for a hunting lease?
Well, that goes back to understanding your deer and understanding your land. Hunters are looking for things like nut bearing trees. Do you have water on your land? Do you have a power line that can be planted into a green field? Do you have a road system? They always like a good road system so they can get the deer out. If your timber has been thinned, do you have loading docks where green fields can be planted? Deer need food, water, and cover. Also, the surrounding territory. Who's on the land around it? What kind of hunters do you have on your surrounding land? Those things are factors in how much you need to charge for your land.
What you've talked about the characteristics of the land. Why don't you talk a little bit about the characteristics of the hunter? What do you look for in a hunter?
It's really important to talk as long as you can to a hunter to find out exactly how do they hunt. After you know something about hunting, if you ask a few questions, then it'll tell you a lot about that hunter. You don't want a hunter coming in that is just going to take everything off your land and leave you without anything. You want a hunter that knows that the first year might not be the best year, because the first year he's learning the land and he might need to do some things to bring some deer in. You basically don't want a novice. If anybody calls up and says, I've never hunted before and I want to get into hunting, pass that person on and let him learn on somebody else's land. You're looking for a good caretaker, someone that's going to improve the value of your land and be with you for a long time. The first question that a hunter asks when they're looking at your land is, who hunted this land last year? And if you're changing hunters every year, then they're going to think that something's wrong with your land.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Janie, we appreciate you joining. You've been listening to Janie Drake. Thank you for joining us, Janie. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lori Rose deals with hunting clubs and landowners every day with Southeastern Claims Services in South Carolina. We wanted to tap into her experience in dealing with hunting accidents and learn how to prevent them. Hello, Lori.
Hello, Hayes. How are you?
What type of hunting accidents have you found to be the most costly?
By far, the costliest accidents are the accidental shootings. They are costly both in terms of the value of the claims as well as a human cost that's involved when someone is fatally injured or catastrophically wounded.
What about the causes of these accidents? These are the ones that are most costly, but where do you attribute these injuries to?
Well, by far, I think the majority of these shooting accidents can be contributed to carelessness, a lack of respect for the weapon. People have a tendency, particularly people that have been hunting for a long time, that maybe grew up in that environment and grew up handling guns, they tend to get an unsafe comfort level with the weapon and with the activities that are going on around them.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to just take for granted that, mm-hmm. that nothing's going to happen. For instance, we've had incidents where people are walking to the stand with a gun loaded, and they step in a hole and fall, and the gun has discharged and killed them. We've had some fairly ugly incidences that have occurred when people took a shot at what they thought was a deer when, in fact, was a fellow hunter, just not knowing their target. People get excited. They see a rustle in the bush or something that they think is wild game, and they'll pull the trigger and shoot with tragic consequences. Another cause, we see a tremendous number of shooting accidents that are caused by dog driving. And the main cause of that is they put the standers too close together, and, of course, the deer runs between them, and they both shoot. And, you know, some people may not be aware of the range of a shotgun or the particular load that they're shooting, and, you know, pellets have a way of ricocheting and reflecting off trees and so forth, and that tends to be the primary causes that we see. But I think it just all goes back to carelessness and, you know, if I dare, in some cases, stupidity.
Mm-hmm. How do you prevent something like this, the carelessness that you're talking about? Are there safety courses or rules and so forth that you recommend?
Well, I recommend that people need to get each state, the Wildlife Department puts out a publication at the beginning of each hunting season that lists the bag limits and the seasons and so forth, and everyone that I've ever seen has some really good safety rules to be followed. In addition, most of the state DNRs or Wildlife Departments have websites that have links. There's a couple of links that have been posted on your page that deal specifically with hunter education in Alabama. What I see, most of the incidents that I see could be very easily avoided just by having the hunt club incorporate some very simple rules, no drinking, no alcoholic beverages while using a firearm, guns are not to be loaded until the hunter is in the stand, not to allow children to play with the weapons, not to leave a loaded weapon where a child can get to it. To always, always respect your weapon, know the load that you're shooting, know its range, fully identify your target before you shoot, and just, you know, have respect for the people around you and for the weapon that you're holding. Some of the things that the landowners can do before they lease to a hunt club is get to know the representative of the hunt club and demand that that hunt club have safety rules and that they abide by them and make sure that their members adhere to them.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the hunt clubs are concerned, most of the successful clubs that I've seen will impose fines if these rules are broken.
Mm-hmm.
If someone's caught in the back of a pickup truck with a loaded gun, walking with a loaded gun, leaves one laying around, if they're caught drinking, some of the clubs are very strict about it and will actually expel the member from the club. Others simply impose a warning system with fines attached to those infractions.
Okay.
All right.
Well, those are some good suggestions for us. We appreciate that, Lori. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Manipulating the environment by herbicides is now becoming quite common, but some herbicides require training and licensing. Dr. Lawrence Graham knows about this, and he has just about the best nickname of any guest we've ever had. Hello, Fudd.
How are you doing this morning?
What are restricted-use pesticides?
Restricted-use pesticides are pesticides that landowners can purchase, but they can only be purchased and used by someone who has a certified pesticide applicator's permit. And if you don't have this permit, these particular materials can't be purchased. A good example, you can go to about Roundup at Lowe's or Walmart to use to take care of weeds around your home, but if you wanted to buy something like Weed Master for your pastures, which contains Picloram, you would need a restricted-use pesticide to purchase that because Picloram is on the restricted-use list.
Tell us how you go about getting that permit or license to use those.
I'm sure some of your landowners might have land in other states, too, and what I'm going to say refers just to Alabama, and it
mm-hmm.
will be different in different states. But in Alabama, what you would need to do is to go to your local county agent's office. and to talk with them. There is a packet there that they can obtain that has a pesticide applicator study manual in it. It has a form to fill out to send to the Department of Agriculture and Industries, and it has a test in there that you need to pass before you can get your license. Now, there are two ways that you can pass this test. Sometimes the county agents will hold meetings in the springtime, usually, to do training for private applicators, and then the test will be given at the end of these training meetings. But I know some people need these permits at different times during the season, so there is a self-study method where you can go by and you can pick up this packet, take the manual home, and it's basically an open book test. We want to make sure that people understand the information. We're not trying to, really give tests to for the benefit of giving a test, but we want people to understand how to use these pesticides.
How long does the license last?
The license will last for 3 years.
Okay. What records do you need to keep if you have one of these licenses?
If you are apply a restricted-use pesticide, you must keep records of the use for these pesticides for at least 2 years. Now, this is not a state requirement, but it is a requirement of the USDA.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Fudd. We appreciate you updating us on that. In our markets chair is Pete Stewart, is a frequent guest on Capital Ideas Live. He's with ForestToMarket.com. Welcome, Pete.
Thank you.
Teddy Reynolds talked about carbon sequestration. What are the implications of this to the forest landowner from an economic standpoint?
Well, I think Teddy spoke to it quite well. There are it basically boils down to a new revenue stream for the forest landowner. Obviously, one thing the forest landowner on a small scale has to deal with is the size of the property and the amount of credits that individual will have, which is quite small relative to the trading block on the Chicago Climate Exchange. But that problem is being dealt with by the aggregators.
Mm-hmm. And they're picking up smaller acreages and putting them together. So.
Correct. And I think over time, as the faith in the transaction and the standards around how to measure these credits and verify them gets more credible, then it's logical to assume that the price will go up accordingly.
The housing market is in a slump, and it's affected sawtimber prices for sure. How long is this going to last?
It sure has. Unfortunately, we're looking at a situation where we have one of the highest inventory of unsold new homes and unsold existing homes in our history. And at the current rate, we believe it will still take almost 16 months to work out the inventory back to a historic four-month inventory level. We're looking at about an eight-month inventory level of unsold homes right now. That means we're into at least late 2008.
Okay. Put on your look into your crystal ball a little bit. Can you forecast what you think wood prices might do over the next 6 months to a year?
The housing slump is obviously affecting saw timber prices and will continue to. So we expect very soft saw timber prices through most of 2008 with no premiums on ground conditions that are custom or common in the wintertime. But the pulpwood markets are strong now, and we expect they will remain strong, particularly with the new interest in wood fuels and the different demands for pulpwood. And corollary to that is that many of the pulp mills in Alabama have switched from hardwood to using more pine, which has driven demand for pine, which if you have pine plantations is certainly a good good thing.
That's some good news for us. Okay, well, thank you, Pete. We appreciate you joining us. And
thank
that's
you.
All the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Charles Mann, Teddy Reynolds, Joe Fury, and Michael Flannery. We also appreciate the contributions of Janie Drake, Lori Rose, Fudd Graham, and Pete Stewart. Several of our guests have spoken about manipulating the environment. One spoke of inviting hunters onto your land for profit. One talked about taking advantage of new products such as herbicides to promote growth, and one has spoken of storing carbon and getting paid for it. These may sound like new ideas, and they are, but manipulating the environment is not new. Humans have been doing that since way before we normally imagine. Think of a time when you think nature was in perfect balance. Was that when you were little, when your grandparents lived off the land, or was it before European settlement? Actually, nature has never been left alone. It's been constantly manipulated by mankind, or worse, by massive geological forces that stripped it bare during the last ice age. As it turns out, manipulating the environment is a time-honored tradition. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.